This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'm interviewing Linda Molnar-Kelly and Adam York, who coordinate the Schools of Opportunity Project at UC Boulder. They recently published an article about this project in the Kappen and will be recognizing additional schools selected for this honor in January. Adam and Linda, welcome. To begin with, why schools of opportunity? What do you mean by this?
Moving towards framing opportunity as the center of focus for this project is a shift away from using traditional achievement measures to look at the quality of education that students are receiving in schools. So achievement measures such as standardized tests tend to sort of highlight and reify the stratification that we see in society more broadly. They pick up on socioeconomic differences, school funding differences, things that are really hard for schools to have any impact on, that are often way out of their control, and pick up on those factors when measuring the success of students. This project shifts the focus to the opportunities that students receive in school rather than the achievements that are coming out of those opportunities. And shifting to opportunity allows us to highlight the things that are within a school's control to change, and things that teachers and principals can actually do to increase the opportunities that students receive on a daily basis.
So when you use the term opportunity, what sorts of things are you referring to?
Well, I think what we're referring to are providing, you know, more enrichment rather than remedial programs that we might find in schools that are focused more on closing achievement gaps. And what that would mean is removing some of the gates to higher level courses, for example, detracking the classes and allowing kids to enroll in AP and honors and concurrent enrollment classes with colleges, providing resources and support for students as they do this, eliminating discipline policies, suspension and expulsion policies that force kids out of school, services that help kids address other kinds of needs that interfere with schooling, such as health and mental health, and basically just giving kids an even chance so that they can pursue their goals and follow trajectories that work for them, that give them some post-secondary options, and that equalize the playing field a little bit.
That's helpful. What can you say about the criteria used to select these schools?
I will go ahead and talk through all 10 criteria that we are using, because we did make some changes for the 2017 cycle by making our first two criteria required of all schools. And this grew out of looking across the last 2 years of data that really, no schools ended up qualifying for recognition who didn't meet these first two. And so the first criteria is broadening and enriching learning opportunities with a particular attention to reducing the disparities in learning created by tracking and ability grouping. So that was the efforts to detrack schools that Linda was talking about. The second criterion is creating and maintaining a healthy school culture with attention to diversity and to reassessing student discipline policies. And so this is sort of a combination of having a healthy and positive school culture and also reassessing discipline policies and possibly looking into things like restorative justice practices within the school. So those first two criteria, broadening and enriching the learning opportunities and creating a healthy school culture, are required of all schools this year for 2017. The others, they get to select four of the additional eight to apply on. And I'll go ahead and read through the other eight. The first is providing more and better learning time during the school year and the summer. Criterion 4 is using a variety of assessments designed to respond to student needs. Criterion 5 is supporting teachers as professionals. 6 is meeting the needs of students with disabilities in an environment that ensures challenge and support. 7 is providing students with additional needed services and supports, including mental and physical health services. 8 is creating a challenging and supported culturally relevant curriculum. 9 is building on the strengths of language minority students and correctly identifying their needs. And criterion 10 is sustaining equitable and meaningful parent and community engagement. So schools will each apply on the first two criterion, and then they select 4 of those 8 that I just read off to apply on. And each of those criteria has their own full rubrics, so you can see what that looks like at an exemplary level, at an advanced level, or at an early planning stages level. All of those documents are available on our website to look at what that each of the criterion look like at different levels.
So why did you choose these specific criteria?
Well, these criteria are all based on research evidence, and they're based upon the principles that are in the Closing the Opportunity Gap book, which is an edited volume by Prudence Carter and Kevin Wellner, the director of NEPC. And they speak very significantly to the body of research that deals with opportunity gaps in schools. And I think what you find different about these criteria are that we're more interested in looking at policies and practices that give kids access in lots of different ways, as opposed to what a lot of the more sort of no-nonsense reforms you'll see in some schools are doing, which is to focus more on outcome-based test score improvement, market-based resources, and they talk more about closing achievement gaps. And so we're basically looking at the ways that schools enact these changes to their policies and practices so that more students have an equal chance in school.
So you've begun to touch upon this, but what is the National Education Policy Center hoping to achieve by sponsoring these awards?
So the National Education Policy Center is part of a larger education justice movement to shift the narrative of discussion around education policies and practices. So as we're stating, we would like to shift away from talking about student achievement and shift towards talking about student opportunities. But even more broadly, I think by recognizing these schools specifically and doing, targeted media outreach work with each of the schools and also at a national level, what we're hoping to do is provide shining examples of schools that are doing excellent work across the broad set of criteria that we have set forth that's based in research that both demonstrates that it's possible to address all of these different factors within a school and give some actual real-life examples of how schools are doing this day-to-day and help them spread that story in their local media work so that even if one of these schools happens to struggle with test scores in a given year, there's a lot more evidence about the quality, high quality support work they're doing for students and what that means for students' life opportunities and outcomes well beyond the test scores.
Can you say more about how schools actually benefit from being recognized as a school of opportunity?
Well, I was hinting at that a little bit by talking about the targeted media outreach. So one thing that we do for them here at the NEPC is to put together a press kit for them that includes press releases, some descriptive language to help them talk about how this recognition program was formed and what those criteria are based around so that they can effectively communicate what this recognition means for them as a school, what it represents, for the work that they're doing, and just effectively spread that story locally through the contacts that they already have. We provide them with a banner that they can put at the front of their school. And we've heard a lot of anecdotal stories from principals about the impact that public facing recognition on the building has for them with parents and community members who come to the school. And then we also do our own write-ups in conjunction with Valerie Strauss at the Washington Post's Answer Sheet blog, where we highlight these schools with more in-depth stories so that their story gets shared at a national level with folks from all walks of life who are interested in education news.
And I would say, Greg, that this generates a lot of interest locally for a lot of these schools, and has often resulted in opportunities for them to partner with community agencies. In some cases, they draw the attention of potential funding agencies for special projects. And we're hearing that although we don't give them any monetary reward, that there's a big payoff for the schools.
So it really raises the profile of the schools and affirms what's happening in a way that kind of brings them to the attention of their own communities and the broader public. It sounds like kind of a real plus for the schools themselves. How do you go about nominating and selecting the schools for this honor?
Schools nominate themselves, or anybody from the school or district can work on nominating the school. Really, the nomination begins with the beginning of the write-up of their application, where they provide evidence on each of the each of the six criteria that they're applying on, and it goes through a review process that includes multiple stages, including a deep dive review into the evidence presented on each of the criteria that they write to. It includes a holistic review from folks, many of them former recipient principals, who have that broad view of what a school of opportunity looks like across the full set of criteria. And then we actually conduct site visits at all of the schools who progress through those first two rounds of reviews, where we have either folks from our team or fellows of the NEPC who work in the cities where these schools are, go to the school, take a tour, talk with families, talk with administrators and teachers and community partners to get a real sense of what the life is like in these schools day to day. For example, on criterion two, understanding what a healthy school culture looks like is very hard to do on paper. So the site visits are a very important part of our process. And then all of the notes and materials from the full three rounds of reviews come back to our core leadership team to make the decisions each year.
So it really sounds as though you're getting a lot more information than just achievement scores. So all of that sounds very positive. What can you tell me about some of the schools that have been recognized as a school of opportunity? What are some of their characteristics? Any stories that come to mind?
Well, one of the things that really struck us last year with the 2017 awardees was that there really wasn't a single profile of a school of opportunity. They're rural, they're urban, suburban, there are comprehensive high schools, there are small magnet schools. We have international schools serving refugee populations. But what they all do share is this commitment to equity and this commitment to providing all of these various services to their students and valuing not just addressing, but valuing the diversity of their student populations. But they all answer and address the criteria in different ways. So I could give you an example. So we have one criterion that deals with health services or additional community services for the school. And last year, there was a school in Vermont, Leland and Gray, very rural, low-income area, where they had a significant number of students who were having mental health issues and a significant number of students that needed dental care. And so they brought in dentists. They provided local mental health supports, and they also provided bus services to other health clinics nearby to address those very important issues that their students, their student population needed. Another school, Urbana High School in Urbana, Illinois, had addressed the same criterion, but the difference was they had a health clinic on site through a community partnership so that their kids could get medical and psychological care at the school. Rochester International School in New York, which is a UN resettlement area, has a significant number of students who speak non-typical languages. So they serve their community through home liaisons that help their families access health and social services. So all of them earned recognition, but what they were doing in that area were basically responding to their own contexts and doing it their way to serve their groups. Very differently.
I'm especially interested in the question of school culture, and I'm curious about like what seems to characterize some of the schools in a more specific way that have been able to create this supportive and positive culture for their students. Are there any examples of schools that have really kind of modified their cultures in this direction that you could describe?
Yeah, definitely. There are Revere High School outside of Boston has done some wonderful things with bullying, and their bullying policies and reporting procedures, and even the district offers these curriculum lessons in bullying that are cross-disciplinary. So they're the kinds of things that come up in regular content classes. They also have student involvement in their programs. So student clubs will sponsor anti-harassment, anti-discrimination activities. And then other schools that we visited also have strong clubs that are student-led. And they might be gay straight alliances, LGBT efforts. And you'll also find in a lot of these schools restorative practices to address behavior issues and conflict. So they might call it restorative justice, they might call it PBIS, but all of these programs are designed to change behavior, but not necessarily punish and force kids out. So the goal is to keep kids in school, to have a safe, welcoming environment. And we have a lot of school examples of that. And we'll be putting that on our website, actually, so that people can access that information about schools that are addressing various criteria in special ways. You want to add anything, Adam?
We have another school here locally, William Smith High School. And I actually had the pleasure of working at that school in an after-school program and teaching one of their intensives before I started working on this project. It was in the same year that they were recognized as a gold school. And everybody who walks through the door of that school notices right off the bat that it feels warm and welcoming. And I think what a lot of that has to do with is the collegiality between students and teachers. Mm-hmm. The teachers are treated as leaders at that school. The students are also treated as leaders at that school. So it's an environment in which everybody feels empowered to be part of creating that school culture. You walk through the doors and you see folks enjoying themselves in the hallway, students and teachers talking about life beyond school and not mm-hmm. just the content of the courses that they're taking. And talking about the exciting possibilities for the future that come out of the great education that they're getting there. But it's not just about doing school. It's about the relationships between adults and students that in large part are fostered by the principal and the other leadership folks at that school who place a really high value on strong relationships. And we see that across a lot of the schools that we recognize.
And several this year have really stood out in that way. And I would also add that teachers are a key part of the healthy school culture and have been trained in a lot of the restorative principles. And of course, all of this also starts at the classroom level. So a lot of these policies are enacted in the classrooms and by teachers as well.
Have you been able to discern any conditions in the school districts or communities where these schools are located that have made it possible for them to develop and thrive?
That is actually one of our research questions at the NEPC and within the Schools of Opportunity program. We are very curious about that question of what districts can do to help schools thrive in these ways. And we are starting to see some commonalities between districts, but we are really curious about that bigger question moving forward, because we're excited about what we see in each of the schools of opportunity individually, but we definitely are interested in whatever can be done to support a larger movement to shifting districts in this direction as well.
So would you say it's too early to make any conclusions or draw any conclusions about factors that seem to encourage or discourage the existence of these schools?
Possibly broad conclusions, certainly evidence-based conclusions would be early at this point, but I think we have some examples from districts. Maybe Linda, you could share a couple.
Yeah. I mean, we found through the application process, as we're looking at what schools are addressing in their write-ups about their schools, that some of them are within districts that have initiated some of the change. So I think I referenced Revere earlier, and that school district has actually initiated policies to improve culture. Other districts that we're familiar with through the applications have made commitments, for example, to bilingualism and to better serving language diverse students. And so some of these districts are now offering a seal of biliteracy so that students can earn certificates when they graduate from high school. And that drives a lot of the efforts at the high schools, who are serving large numbers of English language learners. There are community partnerships that districts nurture that make a big difference in the kinds of resources that some of these schools are receiving. And then I would also say there's in some of the districts, particularly from schools that have very strong supports for their teachers, there's definitely a priority placed on paying attention to their teacher needs, providing professional development and induction programs for their new people, because they recognize that keeping good teachers in the profession is key to having a good learning environment for students.
So that kind of positive work environment is really a critical element of this as well.
It is. And I think that we find that, you know, a lot of the leadership in these schools will say, we have district supports for this, this, and that. And then these other things they do on their own, and the districts allow them to do it. So they're not, you know, having to confront issues with their districts, but rather they receive support. But like Adam said, I don't think we've studied districts' support mechanisms as much as we might. And it's an interesting question.
Do you believe that schools of opportunity are in themselves sufficient to help young people overcome the challenges posed by poverty and discrimination?
Well, I think we'd all agree that we as a country need to invest a lot more resources related to poverty and health and housing, segregation issues, and the kinds of things that lead to these racial and class divides. But there's no doubt from our work with the schools of opportunity that there's a lot that we can focus on that's within the control of schools. And that is what these schools are doing. So these efforts that they're making in these 37 schools now that have been recognized, and as well as more coming in January, have really given us hope that we can see change. We can see more kids going into higher level classes and leaving high school with a clear path towards some kind of post-secondary options. Creating environments where kids are really engaged and frankly happy in school. And for those of us who have high school backgrounds, we know how sometimes unusual this is, but there is this happiness factor in a lot of these schools that are doing really innovative things with their curriculum and letting all kids participate. We have been in schools recently where their kids in very diverse environments are mixing effectively and well, and where they say, we value the diversity of this school. We learn so much from each other. And so I think these are all indicators that these schools of opportunity can make a difference, and that no, we can't solve all the world's problems, but hey, one school at a time, right?
Yeah, the happiness factor, I think, is a significant one. And I'm happy to hear you mention it. I had a chance to visit one of the schools that ended up being selected in Oregon. And that happiness element was really noticeable walking into the school and then just spending time in classrooms. Well, as we begin to kind of draw our conversation to a close, what recommendations do you have for school leaders and policymakers with regard to the creation of more schools of opportunity?
Well, I think we're learning as we go from these schools that we've been recognizing. And I think one of the things is that it seems that a focus on giving schools assistance and building capacity versus turnarounds and hostile, in some cases, takeovers is the way to go. I think that building on the strengths of current staff and students and local communities has made a big difference for a lot of these schools, and particularly as they involve the key stakeholders in the decisions. In other words, their efforts aren't top-down efforts, but rather they're coming from the people who are most directly affected, and that's the students and parents and teachers and staff at the schools. We see schools reallocating resources and investing in their teachers. I think that's key, and particularly right now, I see so many schools that say, well, here's how we can, close an achievement gap by training teachers with these scripts and how do you answer these questions that students raise? And everything is very packaged and rote. That's not the way these schools are headed, are going. And they actually have teachers that are making a lot of decisions, that are playing leadership roles, and that are supported in this by the districts and by the schools. And it's making a huge difference for kids. And I'd also say that they're developing a lot of strong community partnerships.
Much of this seems very reminiscent of some of the things that I spoke with Jeannie Oakes about last month with regard to community schools and just the nature of collaboration, the adoption of more democratic forms of decision making, and in some respects, just essentially trusting both teachers, students, and parents to do what's best for the education of children in a community. Well, I think we're at our time. Thanks, Linda and Adam, for describing this encouraging project. And thanks to our listeners for joining us for this podcast. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. February's Education Interview of the Month will be with Oscar Jimenez-Castellanos at Arizona State, and will focus on his examination of education saving accounts and the makeover of school privatization. We invite you to join us again for February's podcast.